They continued their ride, and Gwen dutifully pointed out all the buildings and their associated history, until Webb was having a hard time keeping track of everything. He was very surprised to look at his watch and see that 3 hours had passed.
"We should probably head back," said Gwen. "For your first ride, 3 hours is plenty. You're going to find yourself a little sore."
"I'm good," said Webb. "I really enjoyed it." The ride had been peaceful, tranquil, relaxing, everything he hadn't been experiencing for practically all of his life. However, when they got back to the equestrian center and Webb climbed off Boo, he was surprised to find that his legs and back were so stiff he could barely walk upright once his feet hit the ground. Gwen noted this and smiled wryly. "Tomorrow it'll be another part of your body that hurts." Webb was already rubbing his buttocks. "I feel what you mean." A couple of hired help came out and took the horses from them. Gwen told Webb that they would take off the gear and scrub and wash down the horses. That was usually the job of the person riding the horse, Gwen said. It helped you bond with the animal.
"You take care of the horse, and the horse takes care of you," she said.
"Kind of like having a partner."
"Exactly like having a partner."
Gwen looked over at the complex's small office and said,
"I'll be back in a minute, Webb. I want to check on a few things."
As she walked off, Webb started taking off his chaps.
"First time on a horse in a while?"
Webb looked up and saw Nemo Strait heading his way. A couple of other guys in baseball caps were sitting in the cab of a pickup truck that had large hay bales in the back. They were watching Webb closely.
"Damn, how could you tell?"
Strait came up next to Webb and leaned against the stone mounting block. He looked off in the direction where Gwen had gone.
"She's a good rider."
"I'd say she is too, but then what do I know?"
"She pushes the horses sometimes further than she should, though."
Webb looked at him curiously.
"She seems to really love them." "You can love something and still hurt it now, can't you?"
Webb had not anticipated this sort of mental process from Strait. He thought he had the big dumb Neanderthal figured out, and here the guy was being thoughtful and maybe even sensitive.
"I take it you've been around horses a long time." "All my life. Folks think they can figure them out. You can't. You just have to go with the flow and never make the mistake of thinking you have them pegged. That's when you get yourself hurt."
"Sounds like a good formula for people, too." Strait almost smiled, Webb noted. Almost. Strait glanced over at the truck where his men still were watching the two closely.
"You really think Mr. Canfield might be in danger?"
"I can't be 100% sure, but I'd rather be safe than sorry."
"He's a tough old cuss, but we all respect him. He didn't inherit his money like most folks around here. Man earned it with his sweat. Gotta respect that."
"Yes, you do. You have any ideas on how that phone might have got into his truck?"
"Been thinking about that. See, thing is, nobody drives that car except him and Mrs. Canfield. We all got our own vehicles."
"When he got in it, it was unlocked. And do they keep their vehicles in the garage at night?"
"They got lots of cars and trucks, and the garage at the house is only 2 bays, and one of them is filled with supplies."
"So somebody, particularly at night, could have accessed the rover, left the phone, and probably nobody would have seen him." Strait scratched the back of his neck.
"I guess so. You gotta understand, out here lots of folks don't even bother to lock the doors to their homes."
"Well, until this is over, tell everybody to lock everything they can. You have to understand, that threat can come from everywhere, inside and out."
Strait stared at him for a long moment. "This free society thing, I've heard of it."
"You know anybody who might be a member or a former member?"
"No, but I could ask around."
"Well, if you do, keep it low-key. We don't want to spook anybody."
"We all got a good gig here. Don't want to see nothing happen to the Canfields."
"Good. Anything else you think I need to know?" Look, if somebody here is in on this, you got to understand that a farm can be a real dangerous place. Big tractors, sharp tools, propane gas tanks, welding equipment, horses that'll kick your brains out if you let down your guard, snakes, steep slopes, lot of ways to get killed and make it look like an accident.
That's real good to know, too. Thanks, Nemo.
Actually, Webb didn't know if that was advice or a threat. Straight spit on the ground. Hey, you keep up that riding, you'll be Roy Rogers in no time.
Gwen rejoined Webb and showed him through the equestrian center. There were 11 buildings in total. The foaling stalls were their first stop, and Gwen showed Webb how they were equipped with closed-circuit television to monitor the expectant mares. The floors were rubber-matted and had a covering of straw to keep the dust down.
We have really high hopes for some of the foals coming next year. We had several mares bred out in Kentucky by stallions with remarkable bloodlines.
How much does that stuff run?
It can run six figures a pop.
That's expensive sex.
There are a lot of conditions attached to that payment, of course, the most important being that the foal is actually born alive and can also stand and nurse. But a great-looking yearling sired by a successful racehorse can bring enormous amounts of money. It's a very picky business, though. You have to think of every contingency, and yet simple bad luck can still ruin your chances.
Webb thought that sounded very much like being an HRT man.
Yeah, the way Billy described it to us, it doesn't sound like a business for the faint of heart.
Well, the money is nice, Webb, but that's not why I do it. It's the rush you get from seeing a horse you raised, nurtured, and trained thundering around that track. The most beautiful, the most perfect racing machine ever created. And seeing the finish line, watching this truly noble animal prance into the winner's circle, knowing that for at least a few minutes, everything in your life is absolutely perfect. Well, there's no other feeling quite like that.
Webb wondered if the nurturing of horses had replaced the lost son. If it had, he was glad that Gwen Canfield had found something in her life she could feel good about.
I guess you probably feel the same way about your work.
Maybe I used to, he replied.
I didn't put two and two together before, she said. I didn't know you were part of what happened to those men in Washington. I'm very sorry.
Thanks. It's a pretty sorry situation all around, actually.
I never really understood how men could do that sort of job.
Well, I guess the easiest way to look at it, Gwen, is that we do that job because there are people in the world who make us do it.
People like Ernest Free.
People just like him.
As they finished at the center, Gwen asked him what Strait had wanted.
Just some friendly neighborly advice. By the way, did he come with the farm or did you hire him?
Billy did. He and his crew came with good references.
She looked around.
So what now?
How about the main house?
As they drove up to the mansion in an open Jeep, Webb heard a roaring overhead and looked up. A small chopper was coming in low and fast. It flew past and disappeared over the treetops.
Webb looked over at Gwen. Where is that going?
She frowned.
The neighboring farm, Southern Bell. In addition to the chopper pad, they also have an airstrip. When their jet comes over, it scares the horses to death. Billy's talked to them about it, but they go their own way.
Who are they?
What are they is more like it. A company of some sort. They run a horse farm too, but a pretty strange one.
What do you mean?
I mean they don't have all that many horses, and the men they have working for them don't look to me to know the difference between a colt and a filly. But they must be doing something right. The house at Southern Bell is even bigger than ours.
I guess they have a lot of buildings like you.
Yes, although the ones we have came with the spread. They've built a bunch of new ones there, massive ones, almost like warehouses, though I don't know what they'd be storing in that sort of quantity. They only came here about 2.5 years ago.
So you've been over there?
Twice. Once to be neighborly, and they weren't. The second time to complain about their low-flying aircraft. We weren't thrown off the place, but it was pretty awkward, even for Billy. And he's usually the one making people feel uncomfortable.
Webb sat back and thought about all this, even as he glanced in the direction where the chopper had disappeared. It took them a while, but they covered the stone mansion from top to bottom. The lower level held a billiard room, a wine cellar, and a dressing area to change into swimsuits. The pool itself was 30 by 60 feet and made entirely of steel from a World War II-era battleship that had been decommissioned, she said. There was a lower kitchen with a Vulcan stove that had a big chrome hood dating from 1912, working dumbwaiters, and a laundry room. In the boiler room, Webb got to see big McLean units kicking out radiant steam heat, and there was a room containing nothing except wooden bins for storing firewood. Each wood bin was labeled for a particular room. The main level dining room had the heads of English stags on the walls and an antler chandelier. The kitchen was impressively large, with Delft wall tile and housing a genuine silver closet. There were 3 ballrooms, assorted studies, parlors, and living rooms, and an exercise room. On the upper floors, there were 17 bathrooms, 20 bedrooms, a library that seemed to have no end, and numerous other spaces. The place was truly enormous, and Webb knew he was incapable of making it totally secure. As they ended the tour, Gwen looked around with a wistful air.
"I've really come to love this place. I know it's too big and grandiose in parts, but it's also very healing, you know?"
"I guess I can see that. How many staff do you have in the house?"
"Well, we have 3 women who come and clean and do laundry and look after things, and then they leave, unless we're having a lot of guests for dinner, and then they'll stay and help. They're all local folks."
"Who does the cooking?"
"I do. It's something else I enjoy. We have a handyman of sorts. He looks like he's a million years old, but he's just lived life really hard. He comes most days. Nemo and his men run the rest of the farm. Racehorses have to be exercised every day, so we also have riders, 3 young women and 1 man. All of them live at the equestrian center."
"And there is a security system. I noted the alarm pad as we came in."
"We never use it."
"You will now." Gwen said nothing to this. She showed Webb into the last room. The master bedroom was vast, but curiously sparsely furnished. Webb also noticed the anteroom off the master bedroom that also had a bed.
"Billy works late a lot and doesn't want to disturb me when he comes to bed," explained Gwen. "He's always considerate that way."
The way she looked when she said this made Webb think Billy wasn't all that considerate. She continued,
"Most people only see the hard side of Billy, and I guess there were more than a few people that were a little skeptical of our getting married. I guess half of them thought I was marrying Billy for money, and the other half thought he was robbing the cradle. But the fact is, we just clicked. We enjoy each other's company. My mother was in the last stages of lung cancer when we started dating, and Billy came to the hospice every day for 4 months. And he didn't just sit there and stare at my mother dying. He brought her things, talked with her, argued with her about politics and sports, and made her feel like she was still living, I suppose. It made it a lot easier for all of us, and I'll never forget that. He's had a rough life, and he's rough around the edges because of it. But he's been everything in a husband that a woman could ask for. He left Richmond, a place he loved, and gave up the only business he's ever known to start over on a horse farm because I asked him to. And I think he knew we had to get away from it all. Too many bad memories. And he was a wonderful father to David, did everything with him. He didn't spoil him because he thought that would make David weak, but he loved that boy with every ounce of his being. If anything, I think losing him destroyed Billy more than it did me, because while he had children from his first marriage, David was his only son. But if he considers you a friend, there is absolutely nothing he wouldn't do for you. He'd spend his last nickel to help you. There aren't many people like that left.
Webb noted the photos on the wall and on a built-in cabinet. There were many pictures of David. He was a handsome boy who had taken after his mother more than his father. Webb turned and found Gwen at his shoulder looking at her son.
"It's been a long time now," she said.
"I know. I guess time really doesn't stop for anyone or anything."
"Time's also supposed to help, but it doesn't."
"He was your only child?" She nodded.
"Billy has grown kids from his first marriage, but David was my only one. Funny, when I was a little girl, I was certain I'd have a big family. I was one of five. Hard to believe my little boy would be in high school now."
She suddenly turned away, and Webb saw a hand go up to her face. "I think that's enough for now, Gwen. I really appreciate your taking the time." She turned back to him, and he could see her damp cheeks.
"Billy wanted me to invite you and your friend up for drinks and dinner tonight."
"You don't have to do that."
"Well, we want to. You saved his life, after all, and if we're going to be spending time together, we probably should get to know each other a little better. Say 5:30?
"Only if you're sure."
"I'm sure, Webb, but thanks for asking."
"Just so you know, we didn't bring any fancy clothes."
"We're not fancy people."
Chapter 32. Claire was walking to her car in the underground garage of her office building when a well-built man in a suit approached her.
"Dr. Daniels?"
She looked at him cautiously.
"Yes?"
He held out his identification.
"I'm Agent Phillips with the FBI. We'd like to talk to you. Right now, if that's convenient."
Claire looked bewildered. "Who wants to talk to me?" Agent Phillips turned and pointed past the garage gate, where a black limousine with tinted windows was waiting, its engine running.
"It'll all be explained, ma'am."
He gently put a hand on her elbow.
"Just right this way, doctor. It won't take long at all, and we'll bring you right back here."
Claire allowed herself to be led out of the garage. Phillips held the door for her and then climbed in the front passenger seat. Before Claire was even settled against the cushion, the limo sped off. Claire was startled when the man sitting across from her in the rear-facing seats leaned forward.
"Thank you for agreeing to talk to us, Dr. Daniels."
"I didn't agree to talk with anyone. I don't even know why I'm here."
She noted that a glass partition that separated the back of the car from the front had been raised.
"Who are you?"
"My name is John Winters. I'm head of the FBI's Washington field office."
"Well, Mr. Winters," Claire began.
"My friends call me Buck."
"Well, Mr. Winters, I don't know why you'd want to talk to me."
Winters sat back. "Oh, I think you have an idea. You're a very smart woman." He tapped a large file next to him. "Quite an impressive CV."
Claire stared at the file.
"I'm not sure whether I should be flattered or deeply annoyed that you've been investigating me."
Winters smiled. "For now, we'll just assume you're flattered. But you also have to realize that in your position, you see quite a few members of the Bureau, their spouses, support people.
All my security clearances are up to date, and it's not like I'm exposed to anything that's top secret. All files are thoroughly censored before they get to me."
"But how do you censor the human mind, Dr. Daniels?"
"What my patients tell me is absolutely confidential."
"Oh, I'm sure it is. And I'm also certain that stressed-out people, folks with serious mental and emotional issues, probably pour out their hearts to you.
some more than others. Exactly where is this going, Mr. Winters?
The fact is, Dr. Daniels, you are in a position to hear some pretty important information given to you by some very vulnerable people.
I am well aware of that, and it goes no farther than my office.
Winters leaned forward again. One of your current patients is Webb London, is that right?
I can't answer that.
Winters smiled. Come on, doctor.
When I said that I do not reveal confidences, I meant it. That includes whether someone is a patient of mine.
Well, just so you're aware, as head of WFO, I'm privy to who at the Bureau is seeing a shrink, okay?
We prefer psychiatrist, or at least mental health professional.
So I know that Webb London is seeing you, Winters said. And I know that he's seen another psychiatrist there several times in the past, an Ed O'Bannon. Again, Claire said nothing. So one thing I want to know is why the switch to you?
And again, I can't answer those.
She watched as Winters pulled a slip of paper out of the file next to him. He handed it to her. She looked down at it. It was a release form signed by Webb London and notarized. It stated, among other things, that anyone providing psychiatric care to Webb London could discuss the parameters of the diagnosis and treatment with one John Winters, director of WFO. Claire had never seen a form like this before, but it was an original document on official Bureau stationery. Now we can dispense with the reluctance.
Where did this document come from, and why haven't I seen it before?
It's a new policy. In fact, Webb's case is the first time we've used it. My idea.
It's an invasion of doctor and patient confidentiality.
Not if the patient has waived it.
Claire read the document very carefully. So carefully, in fact, and she took such a long time doing it that Winters finally started to fume. She handed it back to him. Okay, let me see some ID, she said.
Excuse me?
It says I can reveal certain information to John Winters, head of WFO. All I know about you is you drive around in a limo and say you're John Winters.
I thought my aide identified himself.
He did, but you haven't.
Winters smiled, pulled out his creds, and showed them to Claire. She spent longer than necessary going over them, just to put the man on notice that she didn't like this one bit, and that she was not going to make this easy. He sat back. Now, about Webb London.
He selected me because Dr. O'Bannon wasn't available. We had a good session, and he decided to stay with me.
What's his diagnosis?
I'm not sure I've made one yet.
Have you suggested any treatment to him?
That would be a little premature, she said dryly, since I haven't made a diagnosis yet. That would sort of be like operating on someone before you've even done a physical.
Sorry, but most shrinks, excuse me, psychiatrists I know just prescribe some pills.
Well, I guess I'm not like any psychiatrists you know, then.
Can you tell me what happened to him in that courtyard?
No, I cannot.
Can't or won't? He held up the release form. We can make this smooth for you or extremely difficult.
That form also states that I may withhold any information told to me in confidence by a patient, and also any conclusions of mine based on such information, if using my professional discretion, such disclosure would do harm to the patient.
Winters moved across and sat next to Claire. Dr. Daniels, are you aware of what happened in that courtyard?
Yes, I've read the papers and I've talked to Webb about it.
You see, it goes beyond the murder of six agents, horrific as that is. It strikes right at the fundamental integrity of the Bureau, and without that, you have nothing.
I'm not sure how someone ambushing a team of FBI agents diminishes the integrity of the FBI. If anything, it should evoke sympathy.
Unfortunately, that's not the world we work in. Let me tell you what this ambush has done. First, by taking out our elite strike force, criminal elements now believe we are vulnerable at all levels.
Second, the press has blown this unfortunate incident to such extraordinary heights, using such incendiary language, that the public confidence in us has been badly shaken, and even the lawmakers on Capitol Hill, who should know better, are doubting us. And lastly, the morale of the Bureau as a whole is at an all-time low over this. It really is a triple whammy.
I guess I can see that, Claire said cautiously.
So, the sooner the matter is resolved, the sooner we understand how it happened in the first place, the sooner we can make matters right again. I'm sure you don't want the criminals in this country thinking they can run roughshod over honest citizens.
I'm certain that won't happen.
Are you? He stared hard at her. Well, I'm right in the middle of it, and I'm not nearly so certain as you seem to be.
Claire felt a chill go up her back at the man's words. He patted her on the shoulder.
Now, what can you tell me about Webb without, in your discretion, violating any professional standards?
Claire began slowly, the whole process loathsome to her.
He has some issues. I believe they go back to his childhood, as such issues often do. He froze in that alley. I'm sure he's told the investigators at the FBI that.
She looked at him for affirmation of this, but Winters didn't take the bait.
Go on, he said simply.
Claire went through the details of what Webb had seen and heard in the alley, including the words spoken to him by Kevin Westbrook, how they affected him, his subsequent feelings of paralysis, and how he had fought against them and ultimately won.
Yes, he won, said Winters. He dropped right before the guns fired, and he managed to walk away alive.
I can tell you that he feels enormous guilt for having been the sole survivor.
And so he should.
He didn't suddenly turn coward, if that's what you were wondering. He's one of the bravest men I've ever met. In fact, he might be too brave, too much of a risk-taker.
I wasn't thinking he had become a coward. Not even his own worst enemy could say that Webb London was a coward.
She looked at him curiously. What then?
There are worse things than being a coward. He paused. Like being a traitor.
My professional opinion is that that is not the case. His freezing in that alley represents deep-rooted problems stemming from a very challenging childhood that Webb is trying to cope with.
I see. So perhaps he shouldn't be with HRT, then. Perhaps not in the Bureau at all.
Now Claire could feel herself freeze. What had she just done?
That's not what I said.
No, Doctor, that's what I said.
As promised, they dropped her back off at the garage. As she was getting out, Buck Winters leaned forward and gripped her arm. Claire felt herself instinctively drawing back.
I certainly can't stop you from telling Webb about our meeting, Doctor, but I'm asking you not to. This is an ongoing FBI investigation, and the results, whatever they happen to be, will rock the Bureau more than it's ever been. So I'm asking you, as a good citizen, to keep all this on the QT for now.
I can't guarantee you that, and I trust Webb.
I'm sure you do. There's a lot about him to trust. Do you know how many men he's killed in his career?
No. Is that important to know?
I'm sure the relatives of those people would think it important.
You're making it sound like he's the criminal. I'm assuming that if he's killed people, it was part of his job, the job you expect him to do.
Well, I guess that's always open to interpretation, isn't it?
He let go of her arm and added a parting shot.
I'm sure we'll be seeing each other again.
When Romano and Webb left for dinner at the mansion, Romano was walking a little funny. He told Webb that Billy had gotten him on a horse and Romano had immediately fallen off.
I don't know why the hell I can't follow the guy in a truck. Horses just ain't my thing.
Well, I rode over most of the property today, and a lot of it you can't get to even by truck.
Did you fall off too?
Yeah, twice, Webb said.
Why tell the truth and get Romano's hair up again, he figured.
So who'd you ride with?
Asked Romano.
Gwen. Had a nice time. How about you? Have any fun?
Yeah, I never knew how much fun mucking a stall could be. You should try it sometime.
Billy met Webb and Romano at the front door of the stone house. He was wearing an old corduroy jacket with patched elbows, a pair of khaki pants, a wrinkled white button-down shirt, and loafers without socks. And he already had a drink in hand. He led them through the front hall and down a curving staircase of walnut that looked old enough to have arrived in the colonies as a gift from a long-dead king or queen. Though he'd been through the place earlier, Webb still caught himself occasionally ogling the large rooms, elaborate millwork, heavy draperies, and enormous artwork that looked museum quality and probably was. And then they arrived at the lower level. Romano looked around and kept muttering, "Holy shit," under his breath. Webb again noted Billy's limp. "You have an accident?" he asked, pointing to the man's leg.
"Yeah, a one-ton draft horse decided to take a roll while I was on the sumbitch."
The floor in the lower level was flagstone, the exposed walls stone, and 12x12 beams had the task of holding up the ceiling. There were large leather couches and chairs placed precisely, probably to encourage several conversation groups, or perhaps even conspiratorial factions, for this definitely looked like that sort of place to Webb, though the Canfields didn't seem the type. If they didn't like you, they probably weren't bashful about showing it, especially Billy. The walls were festooned with the racks of yet more English stags, along with numerous mounted heads of deer, a cheetah, a lion, a rhino, a moose, and mounted full bodies of a large variety of birds and fish. Mounted on another wall was a very large walleyed pike. There was also a full-sized grizzly in a charging pose and an enormous swordfish in perpetual soar. On one display table was a coiled diamondback rattler and a king cobra, with eyes seemingly ablaze and fangs showing and ready to do some serious damage. Webb gave both stuffed reptiles a wide berth. He had never cared much for snakes after almost being bitten by an enraged water moccasin on a mission in Alabama. There was a well-stocked gun cabinet against one wall. Webb and Romano enviously checked out the array of Churchill, Rizzini, and Piatti firearms, weapons that would easily set you back 5 figures. You really couldn't be a member of HRT and not be an aficionado of showpieces like these, though most FBI agents lacked the financial wherewithal to do more than press their noses to the glass. Webb wondered if the weapons were for show only, or whether anybody here ever actually used them. Billy looked like he would be comfortable around guns, maybe even Gwen, too. If the man had killed all these animals, he would damn well have to be handy with firearms. A full bar of dark cherry sat against another wall. It looked like it had been yanked straight from a London pub. Webb's strong impression when he had first seen this room was that it had the feel of an English club spiked with a bit of the Wild West. Gwen was sitting on a couch that looked substantial enough to sail in across the Atlantic. She rose when they entered the room. She was wearing a beige sundress that went down to her ankles and that had a scooped neckline, showing a good portion of cleavage. A bit of her white bra strap showed from under the sundress's thin shoulder straps. Her bare arms were browned by the sun and were tight and firm, probably from horse reining, Webb assumed, since his arms were aching a little from doing just that for 3 hours. Black leather flats were on her feet. Still, she was only a couple inches shorter than Romano. As she sat back down and crossed her legs, the sundress slipped back an inch or so, and Webb was a little surprised to see that she wore a gold ankle chain, because it seemed a bit out of sync with her refined bearing. Her face was nicely tanned, too, and the contrast of the blonde hair was striking. Billy Canfield was indeed a fortunate man, thought Webb, though he wondered how much of the life in their marriage had died with their son. Webb was surprised to see Nemo Strait sitting in one of the chairs. The farm manager had cleaned up and was wearing a polo shirt that showed off his muscular physique with chino pants and loafers. He was a striking man, Webb had to admit. Strait raised his glass to Webb and Romano.
"Welcome to Casa Canfield," he said with a big grin.
Webb looked at the numerous animal trophies.
"They come with the house?" he asked Billy.
"Hell no," said the man. "About 4 years ago, I had me a calling, I guess you'd say, to go off and shoot things. Became a big game hunter and a deep sea fisherman. Was even on TV a few times on some sporting shows. Went round the world bagging stuff like that."
He pointed to the tusked head of a wild boar on one wall, and then over at the grizzly, which stood at least 9 feet tall on a specially built display unit, its fangs bared and its long claws looking ready to shred somebody. He went over and rubbed the thick neck of the enormous bear.
"Now this thing did its best to kill me twice. Second time it almost did, but I got it."
He pointed over at the rhino.
"Those damn things look slow and heavy-footed. That is, they do until they're coming at you about 30 miles an hour with nothing between you and your maker but your nerves, good aim, and a steady trigger finger. You aim for the brain. Now, if you miss and hit the rhino's horn, you're a dead man."
"Poor animals," said Gwen.
"Hell, the damn things cost me a fortune," replied her husband dryly.
He looked at one of the stags and then nodded at Webb.
"You know, the stag is the old symbol of virility, wisdom, and life. And there it is, hanging on my wall, dead as a doornail. I kind of like the irony in that. Now, I do all my own stuffing. Got to be a pretty damn good taxidermist, if I do say so myself."
Webb was wondering about the timing of Billy's desire to kill. It must have occurred soon after the trial had ended in Ernest Free's plea bargain that had most certainly let him live. Billy continued,
"Here, let me show you. You want to come, Nemo?"
"No way. I've already seen your little operation, and I ain't had my dinner yet."
Billy led them down a hallway and unlocked a door there. Gwen did not accompany them either. They went inside, and Webb looked around. The place was large and crammed with work tables and shelves, and on these surfaces were cans of liquids and pastes and sharp knives and scalpels, dozens of other tools, large vices, ropes, and complicated pulley systems hanging from the ceiling. In one corner was the skin of an elk, partially stretched over a form, and in another corner stood a wild turkey in all its dead glory. In other corners were stuffed birds and fish and some large and small animals Webb couldn't even recognize. Webb had smelled rotted corpses, and it wasn't that bad in here, but all the same, Webb wouldn't want to breathe it every day.
"You killed all these?" asked Romano.
"Every one," said Billy with delight. "I only stuff what I kill. I don't do nobody any favors on that score."
He picked up a rag and squirted some liquid on it and started rubbing on one of the tools.
"Other folks golf for relaxation. I kill and stuff."
"I guess it's all relative," opined Webb.
"It's therapeutic, I've found. But Gwen don't see it that way. She's never come in here, and I suspect she never will. Now, taxidermy has come a long way. You don't have to build your forms anymore. You can buy real good ones made out of compressed cork, laminated paper and such, and then fit it to what you're mounting. It's still quite a process, a lot of planning and measuring, and you gotta have a bit of both the butcher and the artist in you. The basic steps are you gut the body and then prep the skin. A lot of folks use borax, but the purists, like myself, still poison the skin with arsenic. You get your best longevity there. And I even do some of my own tanning."
"You keep arsenic around here?" asked Romano.
"Tons of it," Billy eyed the man. "Don't worry. I always wash my hands after working down here, and I don't do none of the cooking." He laughed, and Romano joined him, albeit a little nervously. "Then you prep the skull, assemble your wires and such, and then do your filling and final assembling." Webb eyed the room's equipment. It seemed one bare step removed from a slaughterhouse.
"Lots of stuff in here."
"Well, you need a lot of stuff to do the job, right?" He pointed out various pieces. "Like I said, you got your anatomically correct urethane forms for the animals, but I still make some of my own using plaster of Paris, modeling clay, cord-wrapped excelsior, and the like. Ain't got to have everything handed to you, right?"
"Right," said Romano.
"Then you got your chemicals, poisons, and salt. Lots of salt to preserve the skin. Then you need your measurite and calipers for linear measurements and achieving symmetry. Scalpels, for the obvious reason. I use what's called a perfect knife, German-made. Those damn Germans know how to make the knives. It's for skinning and caping. You know, severing the neck from the body hide, for example. The detail work around the eyes and mouth and the like. You got your skinning knives, paring knives, bone saw, shavers, skifes for leather, even a fleshing machine. Now that is a damn fine invention.